trying to see how many people just came back from the Guanyin session. Anybody? Ah, how was it? Good?
Good.
Yeah, it was good. You did the full 7 days? Yeah. It's very special to have the opportunity to do a full Guanyin session. I always used to think, well, it'll come again, I'll do it next year, manana, something like that. But, you know, it's like that famous poem by Robert Frost about how two roads diverge in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not be when traveling along I stood and looked down both to where they bent in younger growth. He's saying there's two roads that diverge. And he said, I took this one, but knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted that I should ever come back to the other one. And part of the meaning is we're often given choices in our life, opportunities, and which way we go sets us on a path. And we seldom get the chance to come back and have the other option that we had at that time. So usually I'm not a hedonist. Do you know what a hedonist is? Grab whatever's in front of you now, enjoy it. But with the Dharma, I'm a hedonist. So if a session comes up, carpe diem, grab it and take advantage of it, because next year you'll never know, right? You know, there's a famous Chan story, even before I started to digress, but there's a famous Chan story about every year these three old cultivators would get together at New Year's and they celebrate. You know, they made it through another year and they renew their vows together. And so they have cups of tea, probably that really exquisite Chinese tea, you know, $100 a half ounce or whatever. And so they, being the first one, said, let's toast. We made it another year. Who knows if we'll be here next year? And just as they were about to drink, the second cultivator said, he says, let's drink today because we don't know if we'll be here tomorrow. And they were about to drink, and the third one said, let's drink to now because we don't know if we'll be here for the next breath. And then they drank. But, there's many ways you can take that, but one is when you have an opportunity to cultivate, especially doing a session, and you can take the time away from your job or your family, really grab it and do it. Don't wait until the next year or the next month or something, because it may not come around. And this is a chance to really deepen your practice. You can do it every day at home, of course, a little bit, but when you go for 7 days and the food is taken care of, you don't have to cook, you don't have to clean. If you don't want to, you don't have to bathe. You know, you don't have to cut your fingernails or hair. You can be sort of just au naturel, right? And you can get into this, and all you do is concentrate on reciting Guanyin's name and the bowing and the meditations and so forth. And it's really a wonderful chance to deeply go into a Dharma door and break free of sort of the normal stuff that holds us. And then after that, your practice, for quite a while afterwards, reaches another level. You can sustain another level. So I encourage you, there's probably going to be, during the winter, there will be an Amitabha and a Chan session. And then there will be another Guanyin coming up this spring. And there's also Earth Store recitation sessions. They're all fairly similar, so it really doesn't matter which one you do, because what you're cultivating is your mind. And you're giving yourself a chance to really cultivate it deeply. So one person went for a whole week. And you're smiling. You shouldn't be smiling. Cultivation is suffering. What are you so happy about? Okay. You're smiling because it's over. Okay, tonight we're going to continue our text here. And let's see where we are. So we're on page 73. And I should announce, tonight is my last night to cover. I'm sure she'll be back tomorrow, Monday. So next weekend he'll be back, and I'm sure there are many stories from China. We're in the middle section here. I believe last week we ended up with Unsurpassed Bodhi, Wushang, Huti, right? Okay, so let's read together the first paragraph here. I'm starting with 4:2. So you can be poor, you can have absolutely nothing, you can even not be able to speak. Now maybe you can't speak because you don't have the language skills. Like me when I go to China, I don't speak. Because I end up making mistakes. The first time I went to China, I really need soap to wash my clothes, and I communicated that and ended up with a glass of warm milk. So my speaking is not very skillful. And if you're Asian and whatnot, you maybe come to the United States, your English isn't good enough, so you can't speak. And you maybe don't have wealth to give. But you can give cultivating according to the teachings. You can embody the way. You can embody the way. It's literal Chinese, it's manifest body speak dharma, which is Chinglish. Manifest body to speak dharma. It means embody the dharma. Be a person of the way, and then that is the highest offering. Okay? So they accomplish these dharmas for accomplishing living beings. What does it mean to accomplish living beings? This is not talking about genetic engineering. Okay, it's not talking about making living beings. To accomplish a living being. It's a kind of awkward expression in English. We don't usually say, what's your job? I accomplish living beings. So what does it mean to accomplish? And what's the expression here? It's
Chengzhou.
Which means, cheng means, I know it means accomplished, right. Is there a better way we could translate this so it makes sense? What does it mean to accomplish? It also means to perfect, to realize, to bring to fruition. So what do? You accomplish a task in English, but you don't accomplish a person. But a person can be accomplished. Accomplish pianist, accomplish student, and so on and so forth. So what do you do if you change this verb? What would you say this would be to what? A living being?
To perfect them.
Right, to bring them to perfection. To help them realize. Anything else? Perfecting living beings would be good. My teacher used to say that Buddhism isn't about something far away, it's about what's close at hand. There is a Tao, a path in heaven, but you don't get to that path except walking the ground under your feet. So this means, then, that by attending to the here and now, you attain the next thing. And therefore he would say, by perfecting your humanity, Buddhahood accomplishes itself. In other words, if you want to be a bodhisattva, sage, an arhat, a Buddha, the way to get there is not by aspiring to something far beyond, but to work on the here and now, perfect your person, perfect your personality, make yourself the best possible person you can. And by continually perfecting yourself, and of course the next page is this wonderful metaphor for this of gold, continually be put in the fire and smelted over, by continually working out your faults and bad habits and perfecting your humanity, and also perfecting these paramitas, like this one really is talking about giving, you perfect your human nature, your human qualities, and Buddhahood comes out of the perfection of humanity, not through denying one's humanity, not through suppressing one's humanity, but actually realizing it or accomplishing it. So here this word means to perfect yourself, to become the best possible person you can, and then things will take care of themselves. Are you going to raise a question? Or?
No, I just meant, how about the word edify?
Edify. Anybody? Do you know what edify means?
No.
Huh? What does edify mean? How would you translate, how would you give a definition of edify?
Well, edify is kind of like to build up, step by step.
Like edifice?
Like a scaffold, mm-hmm. You know, so in a way it's like systematically transforming the movement.
It's actually a good choice of word. The only problem is in English, the connotation of edifying or edification is... No, it's not correct. That doesn't mean correct. It has a holy sacred thing. So I found the church edifying, meaning uplifting the spirit of the soul. So by connotation, although it does mean what you're saying, to build somebody up, in a shaping way. It's used in English to indicate something that is spiritually uplifting. How did you find the lecture? Edifying. It's sort of Victorian English. Most of you would know that if I said, how was the lecture night? You said edifying. You say, oh yeah, right. Clueless. Okay. Using the former two attractions, he gathers in living beings. Attraction, gathering in, these are used interchangeably. These are called the four dharmas of attraction or the four gathering in dharmas that bodhisattvas practice. And it says the former two, meaning which ones? Giving and kind words, right? Now, I'm not sure, at least when I was here, we didn't go over these, did we? Did you go over these with Hung Shir? The four? Anybody remember? Nobody remembers. What are the four then? These are the former two. These are in order. There's four in order. The first one is giving. The second one is kind words or kind speech. What's the third one? It's not mentioned here. He's only practicing the first two. Nope, not courage. Think about, if you try to use your imagination a little bit, if you are trying to gather in a person, how do you go about doing that? In other words, making them feel as if they're safe, secure, they're welcome, they're comfortable, that you're a friend and an ally. I don't mean to manipulate this. Don't say the third one's manipulation. It's not. Okay. But what you're trying to do is create a positive affinity to establish a relationship. So with a relationship of trust and whatnot, then someone can relax and go into the Dharma more deeply. It's an expedient. So giving is one, right? That's the first one. And we do this all the time naturally. When guests come from afar, what do? You send them to a motel. No. You usually have a guest room, right? You give them space. You give them food. You give them, even if they're for a while, you give them tea and nuts or something when they visit, right? During the holidays, what do? You give gifts. You gather in people. Someone new comes to the family. It's their first time. And you pass around gifts and you don't give one to them because they haven't earned it yet. No. Yeah, that's right. No. Come on, folks. Like, I go someplace for the holidays and I've never been there before. You feel gathered in if when the gifts are exchanged at Christmas time, there's one for you. Right? Then you feel like you're a member of the family. You bring your boyfriend home the first time, right? And everybody's giving out gifts and there's nothing for him. What's the message? He's not welcome. So giving is a way of gathering in. It's a way of showing caring and concern for somebody else. So this is the giving. Of course, there's many kinds of giving. We have, but let's just say that's the first one. What's the next one that's mentioned? Kind words. It's really very powerful. If you're new in a situation, or you know your first time someplace, the person that comes up to you and welcomes you with kind words. Oh, it's so nice to have you on board. We're really looking forward to working with you. I'm so happy they hired you. You know, I saw all the other candidates, but I'm really happy. You know, that kind of thing can make you feel really at home and relaxed, right? So kind words. Kind words in a timely manner can be very, very powerful. Very, very powerful. Even as little like my little niece, when she comes over to help me cook, invariably, I pull out the cutting board, you know, that's hidden above the drawer, and she gets so excited, she starts running around, bang, pretty soon she hits her forehead right on the cutting board. So what do I say? Stupid, you did that the last time. No. I say, oh, come let me see that, right? And then we have this thing in the refrigerator, it's some kind of pinky, what is that Japanese thing? Kids like, it's pink. Hello Kitty. Well, she's got a little Hello Kitty freezing thing. So I keep it in the freezer, and then when you get an owie, you take it out and you put it on the owie. And it feels so much better. I use it during Chan when my legs hurt. For my Hello Kitty freezer. I'm just joking. So I take that on and say, oh, it's going to be better, you know, that's okay. It'll go away soon. I say kind of things and she feels better, right? That's kind words. So even though you get older, it doesn't change much. Everybody likes to have kind words when something goes wrong. So that's the second one. Now you have to think, what are the other two? And they must be a little more difficult because the bodhisattva is not picking those up yet. This is a first ground bodhisattva, so this is staged. And he or she hasn't reached the point where they can use the other two. So what's the third one? Think of something.
Long fear.
That's a kind of giving, the giving of fearlessness, but that's a giving. Remember, there's a giving of?
Dharma.
Giving the Dharma. Giving of? Well, giving wealth is the first one. Inner and outer wealth. Giving of the Dharma. And the third of the gifts is the giving of fearlessness. And sometimes kind words is giving of fearlessness. But now we have to think the other two. It's not giving and it's not kind words.
Cooperation.
What's it?
Cooperation.
Sometimes the fourth one is translated as cooperation. But I think it's more complex. So the third one is beneficial deeds. Actual beneficial deeds. Something, and the reason this takes a little skill, to know what people will really benefit by, takes a little insight. It's not quite so simple as it seems. So beneficial deeds means they're really always looking for ways to bring benefit to others. And seldom really concerned about self-benefit. So they're just thinking, how can I help this person? How can I benefit this person? How can I benefit them? Not just in a sort of ordinary way, but in a way that will release them from fear and afflictions to be able to cultivate spiritual. How can I benefit them to raise up their spiritual qualities, to aspire to the highest within them? And then the fourth one is, sometimes translated as cooperation, but it's rendered as similarity in deeds. In other words, you actually take up the occupation or the lifestyle of the being that you're trying to gather in. And that's the most difficult one. In other words, erstored bodhisattva goes into the hells to teach and transform at that level. In the Avatamsaka Sutra, it talks about bodhisattvas who become bandits to associate with bandits. So they seem to be similar in their deeds, but at the same time, it's not what it seems. They're drawing near to be camaraderie one with them, at the same time working within to transform them, to move away. So this becomes much more difficult because it's easy to lose yourself in these things. It's very easy, you know, it's one to say, okay, I'll be similar and I'll be a left home person. I'll be among left home people. That's pretty easy sometimes. Not always, but sometimes. But if you're saying, I'm going to go among bandits, robbers, people who smuggle immigrants across borders, I'm going to go and work in government, where it's a tyrannical government or a despotism. I'm going to go into the military and work side by side with people who are involved with warfare and so forth. Teaching and transforming at that level, that requires a very profound samadhi and very great wisdom. And also an incredible sense of sacrifice, if you will. So that's why the fourth is listed as the most difficult. Cooperation is one of the translations, but I think that's rather weak. Because cooperating means you just sort of get along and cooperate. But here, you're actually, you make a vow to manifest in a path to teach and transform that is not necessarily the holy path. It could be teaching school, you know, or it could be working in a kitchen. And you don't do it as an act. This doesn't mean you volunteer every weekend to serve soup someplace or whatnot. Although that's a little bit, but more, it means you actually enter a career or a lifestyle where you've entered this path and your primary purpose is to draw near and be one with people and to work within to teach and transform. And sometimes you see in the stories from the Jatakas and other places where bodhisattvas have in fact done this in the past. And Shrifu, my teacher, said, these bodhisattvas you don't recognize. It doesn't say, hi, my name's Bodhisattva, at a conference or something. They don't advertise because the reason not to advertise is that their cover would be blown, so to speak. So they work silently. They don't want to be recognized for what they are. And sometimes we don't recognize them until very late in the game. It's like sometimes you think back and some teacher or some friend who really changed your life And without them, you might have gone down a totally different path. Who's to say that they weren't manifesting this way? So this is it, but you'll never really know until you develop the wisdom to see this potential. So this is what bodhisattvas do. Okay, so those are called the four gathering ends, and this bodhisattva, it says, only does the giving and kind words, only, but. And it says the latter two dharmas, the ones we just mentioned, because he only uses faith and understanding, the beginning of his practice has not well penetrated these. He doesn't have the gungfu to take these on very skillfully. That bodhisattva, among the ten paramitas, now usually you think of what? The six paramitas, right? Have you gone through the ten? The ten paramitas? Okay, so tonight, let's see, we have special sweet dew water that if you drink it, you'll win the lottery if you know the ten paramitas. Whoever knows the ten paramitas gets a sweet dew water. Here it is. Now, let's see, does that jog your memory a bit? What are the six? Let's start with the basic six.
Giving.
What's the next one? Shila, morality.
Tolerance.
Come on. That's a third one.
Tolerance.
Patience. Giving, morality, patience.
Diligence.
Then what?
Diligence.
Diligence or vigor? Jingjian. Right? Vigor. Zeal. It doesn't mean stressing out in your cultivation, by the way. Okay? Vigor does not mean burning out. Vigor means you keep yourself in a steady, even penetration of your energy. You don't go up and then come back crashing down. Okay? There's deviant vigor and proper vigor. Deviant vigor is getting stressed out in your practice. That's not good vigor. Okay? This is giving, morality, patience, vigor. The fifth?
Samadhi
or dhyana, concentration. These are talked about the meditation, we could say. Okay? And then finally?
Prajna,
wisdom. So those are the first. Now what are the next four? Added to that are four more that then make it a total of ten. What's that? Is it equity? You're not going to win the sweet dew. I'm sorry. I think I'll have a sip myself. Number seven.
Strength.
Huh? Vows. That's not number seven, but that's one of them. Number seven.
Strength.
Who said strength? Close. It's close. What did you say?
Transference.
No, it's an interesting one though. The seventh one is upaya. Fangbian. In other words, how translating that to English is always a challenge. Anybody want to give a try at that? Usually it's rendered as skillful means. Doing things skillfully. What else?
Expedient.
Expedient. However, again, in terms of what we call connotation, how it's used in English, expedient is usually cutting corners. You know, it's usually a way of working around something, and so expedient is not exactly a good use of that word. Skill means?
Provisional
can be good, right? Provisional is good. Adaptability, being adaptive. Resourceful. That you know, there's, I was going to use this expression because it comes from where I grew up, and it's really a terrible expression now that I think about it. Well, I share it with you. maybe I won't. Well, the old American expression, there's more than one way to skin a cat. Okay, which is, I thought about it as a kid. I never skinned a cat, so I never associated with what it meant. It meant there's more than one way to get a job done. Okay? There's more than one way to make tofu. there's more than one way to get rid of the weeds. Okay? So, in other words, You are resourceful and you find ways that are appropriate. Okay? That's number 7. Now, what's number 8? Now it's your turn. Pranidhana. Pranidhana. Vows. Vows. Particularly, this is talking about the vow to rescue all living beings and your own Bodhi resolve together. I will not realize my own Buddha nature until all living beings realize it together with me and so forth. So pranidhana. But it also means other vows that one makes. For example, my teacher made great vows that sort of become the driving power that bring you back life after life. Not so much your karma, but now your vows are the things that return to guide and bring you back again and again. So making great vows is the 8th paramita. And then the 9th paramita. And this one's a very interesting one. That's the one that you mentioned. You said strength. It's bala, B-A-L-A. And it does mean strength and it also means power. But unfortunately in the 21st century when I say that, I'm afraid that conjures up all kinds of funny images. Right? Strength and power. What do you think of when you think of strength and power?
Abuse.
Abuse. Well, you go right to the heart of it. Yeah. Strength and power is abuse. Well, there's a famous saying of Lord Acton, power tends to corrupt, absolute power corrupts absolutely. So that power has a corrupting influence. How many of you have seen how many read the Hobbit trilogy? Okay, now how many have seen the movie? Yeah, now the hands start to go up, right? As soon as Shakespeare gets more movie, people will read it. But have you guys seen the Hobbit trilogy? Lord of the Rings? Mm-hmm. Who gets corrupted by power in there? Who gets corrupted by the power of the ring? Well, yeah, the little hobbit. But who's the one that really got corrupted by the ring? What's his name? What's his name? He used to be a hobbit and then he became ugly and disfigured in his form because of his lust for this ring, but mostly the power the ring brought. What's his name? Who? Smeagol. 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 Right?
My precious.
That's the one, right? Right. So, what it's saying, though, about power is that power is something that if we get it, it actually corrupts our soul. It begins to corrupt us. Because abuse comes with power unless there's virtue. And that's why the Tao Te Ching says, virtue, Tao Te, the power of virtue, is the only power that can cut without harming. All other powers cut, like a sword, cuts those that it touches and cuts the one that's holding it. But Wei virtue power, Tao Te, is the power that can cut without harming. So to have power and not harm and abuse it requires great virtue. Requires great virtue. So that's why the calling it power, strength, sometimes it's misleading, especially because we live in times when a power is so abused. So here, it's more like the strength associated with Dasher Jirakusa, great strength bodhisattva. And in fact, this, I think, is the image. This is the image of great strength bodhisattva. And that's meant to convey power and strength that is not corrupted. It's the power to stay with something once you start it. It's the strength to come back again and again against adversaries and against opposition, to just return and return and return. It's actually a power of kindness and compassion. One of the things, for example, I've seen, I'm watching some of the situations in the news, and they're saying that young men growing up, do not have models of strength coming from compassion and kindness. They have macho models of overpowering, of violence, of muscularity, of hardness, but they don't have the real models of strength of someone who is strong in compassion and kindness. For example, there was just an incident at a school nearby here, a very unpleasant incident, some of you know about, but the boys really did abusive things. And one of the things I heard somebody say was, they don't have models of men who are strong in their compassion. They have models of strength that are overpowering, abusive, taking advantage of people, and then masking feelings. So to have a man who is strong, who shows feelings, but is also compassionate, this is like the ideal, and this is what this ninth one, Bala, is talking about. It's a strength that comes from completely at ease with yourself and being whole and complete, not feeling deficient, not feeling threatened. In fact, there's an interesting study done a number of years ago that said in boys, in young men, compassion is learned and modeled not from the mother, but from the father. Not from the mother, but from the father. So boys learn compassion through the father. Now, if the father is not compassionate, or the father's not there, then, and they say there's a neurological window within which this develops in the development of children, that if that isn't modeled and not there at that time, that boy will grow up deficient in compassion. It can be filled in a little bit later, but if the direct model of the strong father is not there, the strong, compassionate father, the empathy, compassion doesn't get developed. And those boys then end up being prone to violence and aggression and so on and so forth. So this is a very interesting kind of thing. So this strength that's being talked about here is that strength that comes from being a whole, complete person, comfortable, at ease, and not abusing power, and not needing to abuse power. This is to have a father like that is a very rarefied and a very precious thing. Okay, and then the last one is called Dhyana. This is very similar to Prajna. It's not just knowledge, it doesn't just mean ordinary knowledge, but it means knowledge that's verging on wisdom. So it involves both worldly skill with worldly things, how to do that, but also knowledge in the spiritual. So jhana is often interposed with prajna, very similar. So those are the 10. 6 plus... I know, but 4. Yeah, 6 plus 1 is 10. Good. I wasn't asking a math question. And 4 from 6 is 2. Okay. No. So it's the 7th is? Upaya. Good. The 8th? Bala. Bala's. Pranidhana. Bala's. The 9th? Bala. Mahastaprapta, that's the Sanskrit word, great strength. And then the last one is jhana, knowledge. Okay? Good. So these are the 10 paramitas. But all of those 10, this bodhisattva emphasizes the paramita of giving. Yes?
How is
what? I'm not sure, but usually, you know, in the text, jhana comes before prajna. So jhana is an intermediate stage in the text before prajna. And jhana is usually represented as coming from insight from meditation, you know, and not from study. So, you know, there's literary prajna, there's contemplative prajna, and then there is what, for want of a better translation, real mark prajna, what they call it. And this means prajna that is innate and immediate. It doesn't have to be activated by study, and it doesn't have to be activated by contemplation. It's available to you all times. That's called shirshyam prajna, real marg prajna. So jhana is usually represented as before real marg. And it's usually associated with a kind of knowledge that comes out of the meditation practice of the dhyanas, of the 4 dhyanas. I wouldn't spend too much time on the distinction here, but there is some. And I don't know exactly what that distinction is. But both of them have to do with not just mere knowledge, erudition, but they have to do with the knowledge that comes from insight, from meditation, contemplation, and also prajna that's been released completely in you so that you don't even have to... You know, sometimes some situation comes up with something in Buddhism, somebody asks you a question, and you say, very good question. Think about it. And what you mean is, I have no idea how to answer that. And then you run home and you look it up in the sutra or in Buddhism A to Z or Buddhism for Dummies or whatever. That's literary prajna. Okay? And you come back and say, blah, 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 blah. Okay? And then they ask another question, or you do something. And only when you're sitting in meditation do you see, ooh, that was not so smart. I shouldn't have said that. Or somebody asked me a question, and I didn't give a good answer. Why are you a vegetarian? And unlike some people, I don't like to kill. And you think, oh, that wasn't very upaya. And when you're meditating, though, you think of a better answer. You see a better way to do it. That kind of prajna is contemplative prajna. Or sometimes you're not sure which to do with your life or whatnot, or a situation, a relationship comes up. But when you meditate, all of a sudden, it starts to clarify and you can see what to do. That's a contemplative. But the real mark, and jhanas of those two, the real mark prajna is it's there 24/7, not mediated by anything. You're always in that state. That's what real prajna is. Okay? Anyhow, good. Any other questions? Okay. So he emphasizes the paramita of giving, the first paramita. It's not, and this is very interesting, it's not that he fails to cultivate the remaining. In fact, the Bodhisattva is working on all of these all the time. Working on giving, working on patience. And my Lord, how many opportunities do you have to work on patience? I don't mean TS, I mean CE. And some of you are thinking, oh, I'm a doctor, I work on patience. No, that's not what I'm talking about. Any opportunities to work on patience? No? The world as you meet it presents no opportunities to develop your patience. Wow, so like you guys go home to the Pure Land, huh? Not the world I live in. Oh, there's, I mean, just listen to the evening news. If that isn't enough to test your patience, right? Read the number of bills that are coming out of Washington. That'll test your patience, right? Sitting in traffic, the bridge breaking down. Well, we might have it fixed tomorrow, we might not. Patience, patience, gotta have patience, right? So, it doesn't mean that he doesn't cultivate the other ones, but he only, it says, he doesn't fail to cultivate, but he only does so according to strength and proportionately. This is a very important passage. This is a very important passage. Now, yes, it's talking about the Bodhisattva. And it's talking about how the Bodhisattva, at this beginning stage, cultivates one very deeply, the first one, giving. And this Dana Paramita is a really very profound one, but it's something that's manageable. The others get more difficult and require more skill and more practice and so forth. But the line here, according to strength and proportionally, is a message to all of us in our practice to do the same. Okay? In our practice to cultivate according to our strength and proportionally. Not too much, not too little. So my teacher had a famous thing. He says, too fast and you'll trip. Too slow and you'll fall behind. Not too fast, not too slow, you get there right on time. Okay? So, it's very easy to mistake this statement here, strength and proportionality, to vigor, and get confused. It's right here. And people will say, for example, oh, I'm going to do one meal a day. Okay. Can you handle that? Well, I can force. No, no, no. It doesn't say. He cultivates according to forcing it and willpower. Okay? No, this is what it means to be kind and compassionate to yourself. It means figuring out your strength. Treating yourself like a child. If you want a child to learn how to walk, and they're just 1 year old, get up, come on, do it. You're not going to sleep until you walk. You know, what will happen? The kid will just end up, you'll break the child. You'll break its will, you'll break its strength, you'll break its spirit. So what do? A little bit, the child gets up and stands at the end of the table, and one of the parents do, bells and whistles, and then the child makes another step, and it's a lot of praise and whatnot, and they say, no, no, rest, 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 shee, right? Don't force it. So the same way you would nurture a child, nurture yourself. Nurture the child as you would nurture yourself. Nurture yourself as you nurture a child. Be kind to yourself. Don't force it. Don't take on, I'm going to sleep sitting up. I saw that Dutanga practice. Right. And you can't do it. You're not getting enough sleep. And what happens in the morning? You're mad. You're angry. And it's like, that'll help me cultivate patience. and you start spinning out on this, right? But I'm giving my bed away. I'm just going to sit in a box. No. See, you do it proportionally. If you can sleep sitting up, maybe you want to do it, maybe you don't. Why would you want to do it? Because I'll get enlightened faster. Oh, I see. Already, you're stepping out of bounds. That's not vigor, that's greed. Okay? So you need to measure yourself. If you get afflicted when you're cultivating, there's two reasons. One is good, and the other one's bad. What's the good reason you get afflicted? You're seeing better, and you're actually seeing, look at all my afflictions. I have a wonderful collection. Some people have stamps, some people have coins. I have afflictions. I got the whole list. I got 108. You want to see them? And I got them in degrees of, weak and intense. Right? No. So when you cultivate, and you really cultivate, light returns to you. And when the light returns, you can see things more clearly. Part of doing a Guanyin is that things start to come up that you didn't see before. Afflictions, troubles, worries, faults. You can see things more clearly. That's good. That's good arising afflictions because it's coming from generating the light. And by them coming up in that way, it allows you to face them and just sweep them away. But there's another kind of afflictions that come up that aren't good. And these are self-generated by pushing yourself too hard. Pushing yourself too hard. A lot of this comes from imitating others. Okay? You say, I can leave home. I could do what they're doing. I can do it at home. I can sleep sitting up. And you start to get in a competition thing. Or you say, let's see. I can sit for an hour and just... She sits for an hour and a half. I'll sit for 2 hours. spotlights. See me? I'm really good. Comparing yourself to others is a very deadly habit. Each person is different. Why do we have upaya? Because each person's potentials are different. And what for you might be vigor, for another person might be laziness. And what for another person might be laziness, for you would be vigor. So the middle way is not some absolute fixed thing. It's adjusted to your nature and potential. If you find yourself in your cultivation getting uptight, stressed out, and so forth, and it's not just the natural afflictions arising, you need to pause and remember this passage, according to strength and proportionately. Man manzo. Okay? Go along. Shape yourself. Okay? This is very important because a lot of people I talk to end up tying themselves in knots because they're trying to push too hard on their practice. They're holding themselves to these incredibly high standards. Relax. If you're on the path, you're holding the precepts, you're doing the practice every day, let it go. Let it take its course. Don't help the rice grow. the famous story where the father goes out to help the rice grow and pulls up all the rice, and of course they all die. Because he's pulling them up, making them grow fast. Be kind to yourself. Now that doesn't mean I heard Dr. Rubin talking, I'm just going to lay back, man. It doesn't mean you just lay back and don't have some vigor, but you have to find that point of balance. You have to find that point of balance. This is very important. If you force it, you're not going to get there any faster. Actually, you're going to not get there. You're going to get there slower if you get there at all. Is this clear? It sounds clear, but when you actually get in that state, if you're losing your sense of humor, and you're getting uptight and you say, I better sit. It's time to sit. Whoa. Where's the joy? That comes after your lady. No, it doesn't. As you hope to arrive, so proceed. This is a dictum out of pedagogy of teaching. As you hope to arrive, so you proceed. As you hope that the end will be, do that all along the way. Okay? Means and ends are related. If you're trying to find joy and happiness, find it in the here and now and have joy and happiness in your cultivation. Don't say I'm going to be miserable now, I'm going to beat myself now, but Amitabha is going to pay me big time. Okay? So remember, there's not a single day that goes by that you're not happy. That's what my teacher said. The ancient sages had no other method, but they didn't let a single day go by that they weren't happy. Okay? So it's almost bedtime, you're falling asleep, you better find something to make you happy. No, I'm just... Okay? Any questions on that? I know some of you think about this and have personal questions, but you don't have to ask me personal questions, but as the principle goes, watch yourself very carefully here. Okay, your question.
How do we know we're striking the right balance?
How do you know you're striking the right balance? Anybody? How do you know when you're full? When it's time to eat and you're hungry, how do you know when you're full? If you can know when you're full, you can know this. How do you know when it's time to put on clothes, like your blanket, or to take it off? It's very natural. It's very natural. We know when it's time to sleep. We haven't had enough or we've had too much. We know when it's time to eat. Now, sometimes we eat too much. Okay, when it's really bad food, we're bodhisattvas and we think, I will take on the suffering of eating bad food and eating too much. And when it's good, you don't eat enough because you say, I don't want to indulge. No, it's usually the other way around. Okay. When it's good, you want to have more, and when it's bad, you eat less. But if you just listen to me, you know when it's time to stop. Okay, that's why we don't talk when we eat. A scattered mind and confused talk make the offerings hard to digest. Oh, really? Yeah, so you're not... When you don't talk, you can listen to your body. The other thing we know biologically is if you eat at a natural pace and don't have fast food and eat it fast. I mean, fast food is bad enough, but eating it fast is even worse. Your natural biological mechanism that tells the brain,
oh, you're full.
See, there's something inside your body that goes, hello, you're full. But it takes a while to get to the brain. The food goes down the stomach, and the stomach goes, wow, yeah. I mean, that's enough. Somebody should go tell the brain. Right, goes, you go, I went the last time, man. It's a long climb. So by the time the message gets to the brain, which says full, you won't know to stop. But if you eat slowly, it has to naturally and you'll feel it. This is very true. If you eat fast, you'll eat more than you actually need. But if you eat slowly, the cutoff point will be coming naturally through the body's signals. So the same way with cultivation. Same way with cultivation. Eating, sleeping, wearing clothes, I know, jirzu chang le. Knowing enough, always happy. Knowing when to stop, never in danger. Now this sounds so simple, but you know, it's amazing. Knowing what's enough food and clothes and sleep almost seems like prajna. Do I have enough clothes or too little? Do I get enough sleep or not enough sleep? Well, I do if I take that pill. See, that's not it. You know, just knowing what's enough on the simple things like this is actually a kind of wisdom. My teacher gave a wonderful lecture about this. He said, I'm going to talk a very ordinary dharma. The beginning of wisdom is knowing when you've had enough food, clothes, and sleep. And everybody goes, wow, every kid knows that. Yeah, but look at the overweight problem in America, obesity. And now it's happening in China. Why? It's overpowering the natural thing with the mind that always wants more. And so there isn't a sense of when it's enough. And you'll see people will literally eat themselves to death. On the other hand, I see these really tragic stories of young women who want to be models and then don't eat enough. They get anorexia and bulimia. Okay, they eat a little bit and then they throw it up because they want to have the taste of the flavor, but they don't want to gain the weight. And they actually lose such sense of proportion that they end up being as thin as that microphone stand and still thinking they're too fat. This is how the mind becomes distorted like that. I mean, every time I look at a television thing, there's something on about dieting, losing weight, you know, and people are, why is this a problem? 90%, the United Nations estimate that 90% of the deaths in the modern industrial, post-industrial countries come from too much, excess, not from deficiencies. When's the last time somebody you knew died of vitamin D deficiency? Beriberi, scurvy.
No, I can't.
How about high blood pressure, cholesterol, overweight, diabetes 1, 2, and so on and so forth? Too much, not enough exercise. So knowing when's enough with food is just a very interesting thing. And you're bombarded all the time, right? You drive home tonight, you're going to see signs and hear things about food and more and getting. And then how about clothes? How much is enough there? I keep getting these magazines in the mail, and sort of like, the new latest jacket. Okay. Last year's doesn't keep me warm anymore? It's not cool anymore. Kids, when they go to school in the fall, even though the clothes might still fit them, can't wear those. It's not the latest trend. So parents with kids end up spending a lot of money, not because the kids really need clothes, but they need fashion statements. I mean, how much are jeans now? When I was a kid on the farm, jeans were what you wore because they were the cheapest thing. And when you got holes, your mom would put patches on. And then there'd be patches on top of those. Right? And then you pass them on to your little brother. So all the clothes were hand-me-downs, right? We go shopping once every 10 years or something. Now how much is a pair of jeans? Oh, yeah, $40. You may be shopping at a second-hand store. No, I hear jeans, $100, $200, $300, $400 for a pair of jeans. Yeah, I know. And sleep's the same way. We don't know when's enough rest. We work so hard, we stress out, we can't sleep at night. And we take pills to fall asleep. And then when it's time to get up in the morning, we're not rested, but we have to take a pill to pep ourselves up to get through the day. And so the very natural cycle of knowing how much sleep and not enough sleep gets lost. So this sounds very simple, but it's actually very complex, or interestingly complex. So proportionally, according to strength, the answer to your question, listen to yourself. My teacher had a wonderful expression. He said, listen to yourself and think everything over. Listen to yourself. You have a good knowing advisor within. Listen to that good knowing advisor. Make offerings to that good knowing advisor. Draw near to that good knowing advisor. Listen to the instructions of that good knowing advisor. He says there's a Shantrasher and there's an Ujrasher inside. There's also a bad knowing advisor. You need more. It's not enough. You don't look good. Buy that. Get this. Right? Sit up all night. Don't get sleep. You can meditate. You'll get enlightened tonight if you do. And the Shantrasher is saying, "Mind my soul, get a little sleep. Lazy." You know. So you have this inner thing going on. Listen to your good knowing advisor and learn to follow them. This is developing inherent wisdom. And we have that capacity. My teacher would always say, how did you lose touch with that? It's something even as children we sort of have. You know, I go out with my little niece, and she's tired. She's tired. She's gone. I got her on my shoulder, and she's gone. You know, there's all this stuff going on. She's just sleeping away, right? She doesn't have a trouble figuring out when it's time to go to sleep. When she's hungry, she eats. If she doesn't eat, she cries to let you know that you should know that she's hungry and feed her. And when she's tired, she sleeps. And if she's too hot, she rips her clothes off. And if she's too cold, she goes over and grabs a blankie and warms up. And as we get older, we forget how to do this. And I started to think, why do we go to school? And dumb we forget. Dumb, we get dumb as we grow older in this way. Why? I'm making fun of it because our will and our desire starts to rule us rather than our natural abilities. That's why Lao Tzu said, a sage at all times hears and sees no more than an infant hears and sees. He's pointing to this quality of natural perception, natural knowing, artlessness. Okay, let's do this next passage, or maybe not. Well, you know what I was going to do tonight? I'll just do it. I'm up for stories. Again, I've been spending time with my grandniece, and she doesn't like my lectures. So seriously, she gets very bored with that. Unless I'm holding a persimmon or a chocolate cookie. Why she likes persimmons, I don't know. There's something about the texture of those hard persimmons when you peel them. You know what I mean? The hard persimmons? Yeah. Are they persimmons?
Yeah.
The orange? And you peel them and they have this real, because her teeth, she likes that they're messy. So So she's over at my house, and I give her one to make her happy, and of course, I'm just looking all over the furniture, all over the windows. There's persimmon prints, right? And then she dropped it, and it rolled into the fireplace where the ashes are. Oh, cosmic collapse. She's crying, crying, crying. So I said, I'll get it out, and wash it all off. Her mother's been, oh. And finally, it's clean again, and she's happy, and she's doing this persimmon. That makes her happy. Me lecturing does not. Okay? So finally, you got it, everything's all set. It's just time to go home. And your mother's got it all cleaned up. She's just going out the door. Where's my simmon? So she had to have that in the car to go home. By the time they got home in the car, it was all just smeared with it. Okay, but she does like stories. Okay, so I've been doing, and she likes the Jatakas. I don't read them quite like it is here. I sort of change the language a little bit. But she loves to hear these stories. The allegories, the stories of the Buddha's past life. So, tonight, I'm going to read one to you, one of my favorite ones. And the reason I chose this one is because I just did it with her. I modified it a great deal to do it with her. But I wanted to share it with you tonight. One, because it's a famous Jataka, and you've probably heard it before, but you haven't heard the preface to it. You know, with each Jataka story, when the Buddha tells the story of the Jataka, it's preceded by a passage where he describes how this isn't the first time this thing occurred, or this event occurred. It happened a long time ago in previous lives, and he tells that story first, okay? So usually what triggers a Jataka, something while the Buddha's teaching happens, some of the disciples came back and said, oh, we saw this and this happening. And the Buddha said, this isn't the first time this kind of thing transpired. And then he tells this Jataka story. So, although you might have heard this Jataka story, I don't think you've heard the preface to it. And so what I'm going to do is we're going to do an interactive thing here. We've been talking about giving, right? And the first ground is really about benefiting. Happiness and benefiting. The ground of happiness comes from benefiting. So this story is rich with examples of giving and benefiting, but it's also got elements of the opposite. Okay? So I'm going to read it slowly, and when you hear a passage or an example from this that indicates one of the types of giving or benefiting, just raise your hand. Say, there, okay? And when you hear the opposite, you can also raise your hand and say, there. Okay? Okay, so here's a story. I'll try to modify it as I go along because this is an early translation written in Victorian. So this story, this Jataka, was told by the master while he was in the Jada Grove about the mother of an elder named Prince Kashyapa, the daughter, we learn, of a wealthy merchant in Rajagraha, was deeply rooted in goodness, and she scorned all worldly things. So there was this daughter, let's start there, and she was deeply rooted in goodness, and because she was rooted in goodness, she wasn't attracted to perfumes and cosmetics and clothes and all this sort of thing, and name and fame. Okay? And she had realized, because she was good, that she had reached her final birth in this state of an ordinary person. And she glowed with the hope of now becoming an arhat. She knew that she was ready to make this transition. And what's interesting about this is she knew she was ready because she was losing interest in worldly things, and she felt good about it. This is a sign that you're ready to move on. Sometimes we lose interest and we think, oh, they're depressed, give them antidepressants. But sometimes we lose interest, it's a sign of growth. It's a sign of healthiness. So she loses this interest, and it says, as a lump in a pitcher wants to come out, so that she wanted to come out. And so as soon as she had this knowledge of herself, she even took less joy in the worldly life, and she longed to renounce the world. Nobody said anything so far. I detect a little giving here. What's the giving? We talked about it here. The giving of renunciation. The giving of renunciation. That's a gift. Okay, so she was already giving to herself. She wanted to move on and be an arhat. With this aim, she said to her mother and father, Mom, Dad, my heart takes no more delight in this worldly life. I really want to take up and embrace the teaching of the Buddha. I want to leave home. Will you let me take my vows? Okay? And mom and dad said, ah, oh, my dear, ours is a very wealthy and important family. You're our only daughter. You can't take the vows. We need you to continue the family line and have children and grandchildren.
There.
Ah,
well, yeah, there's a case of not giving. And not giving kind words, not giving beneficial deeds, and not supporting. You know, not supporting her. And yet, from the parents' point of view, she's the one that's not giving. This is very interesting. You can read these Jatakas. I don't do this with my niece, get into the complexity. But you know, you have to read in here. There's some very interesting stuff going on. The parents think that it's her turn to give and not be so selfish, to think of them. And so from their point of view, for her to give is to get married and have children. From her point of view, they're binding her into another kind of realm of attachment and so forth, not letting her go forth. So again, point of view here is very important. Who do you side with? Don't say, well, the correct answer is the girl. But sometimes we need to reflect. When we think it's giving, it may be actually self-benefit we're thinking of. The parents here might reflect and say, is it fair to ask the children to fulfill our wishes in this way for the children and grandchildren? Is this a reasonable thing, or is it unreasonable? Especially if the child doesn't want to do it. Should we force her into a marriage to have children and grandchildren when she really doesn't want to? Later you'll be really happy, believe me. See, this is something, and it's the same thing that applies to career and pushing children into various professions and so forth. You need to really think this through. You say, well, it's hard love. We're, it's for their benefit. But whose benefit is it really for? Anyhow, this is very interesting. So what she did, she rebelled and left home. No. So she couldn't win her parents' support, and she asked them again and again and again. Okay, but they still wouldn't give it to her. And so finally she said, okay, I'll get married and I'll go into another family, because this is traditional India. So when the girl gets married, she goes, I just found out an expression. What's the expression? I was talking to someone in Chinese. When you have a relationship with a daughter in the other family, it's why something. Like there's, when you have grandchildren that are of the son, it's one thing, but if you go out, there's an expression that's used that starts with Y, meaning the outside relation. So when the girl goes to the husband's family, there's some term that's used to describe something that...
White.
Yeah. So it's interesting, but in the Chinese it's the same way. The girl then goes to the other family. Okay? So she says, okay, I'll get married, I'll go to this other family, and then I'll get my husband to consent to let me go and leave home. Now, you could say she's really smart, or she's really naive. I mean, like, your parents wouldn't let you, but your husband will be like, sure, go ahead. I don't know. But it shows that she has patience. So, when she was growing up, she entered into another family. She was a devoted wife, and lived a life of goodness and virtue in her new home. And now came, you know, to pass that she conceived. In other words, she became pregnant. But she really didn't know that she was pregnant. It was too early on. Okay? So here's how the story goes. And there was a festival in the city, and everybody kept the holiday, and the city was like decked out like Berkeley at Christmas time. And even at the height of the festival, she didn't anoint herself. In other words, she didn't put on all the nice stuff and the perfumes and anything, and put on any finery. She took one on her sweat clothes. That's what it says. Okay? Brahmin sweat clothes. She just didn't get dressed up. She didn't comb her hair. She didn't put on rouge and makeup and lipstick and everything. And her husband said, oh, wifey, dear wife, everybody is making merry with the holiday. But you've not put on anything. You're not coming out. And she says, husband, she replied, this body is filled with 32 component parts. This is the contemplation she's doing now. Why should I be adorned? This bodily frame is not angelic. It's not a saintly mold. It's not of the Devas. It's not made of gold and jewels and yellow sandalwood. And it doesn't come from, it takes not its birth from lotus flowers, white and red and beautifully fragrant. And it's not filled with any immortal balsam, you know, fragrant immortal substance. Nah, this body is pretty corrupt. It's born of mortal parents, pretty messy. The qualities that mark it are the wearing and wasting away, decay and destruction of the merely transient. And it's fated to end up in a graveyard. And it's devoted to lust and pleasing itself. It's a source of sorrow and the occasion of much lamentation. It's the abode of all diseases and the repository of the workings of karma. This is not an ordinary girl telling her husband why she doesn't want to go out to the ball. She says, and it's fall within, and it's also fall without, because it's always excreting stuff. I mean, this is true talk. It's not, you know, this girl's right on. And she said, yeah, and all the world can see that it ends in death. It goes to the charnel house. The charnel house is where they prepare the bodies. And there, to be the dwelling place of who? The worms. The worms will take up residence in this place. And she said, husband, what should I achieve by tricking out this body this way? Would it not be, here's the language, I'm sorry, would it not be like putting a debutante's dress on a toilet? Now, this must have had a very romantic effect on the husband. It's like, wow. He says, dear wife, enjoying the young husband, if you regard the body this way, I think you should leave home. Now, she was actually really smart, or she just spoke her true heart. He just said, look, there's no way I want to keep you around in this state. Now, so what do we have here? Is this giving or what?
Giving.
Yeah, I think it's giving. He's letting her do what she wants to do. He says, look, I listen to you. I see what you're talking about. I'm not going to stand in your way. You obviously don't want to be married to me or anybody else. You've got a different calling, and I'm going to honor that. That's very hard often for people to do. You know, you're in a relationship, and suddenly somebody wants to, not even leave home, they want to go to a retreat. Why do you want to go there? And you keep calling on the phone. What are you doing? You think you'll leave me home? No, seriously, this is how it is. I'm telling you the truth. I know this from my own experience. Okay? So he says, she said, oh, if I'm accepted, I will take my vows this day. And he said, really good. I will help get you admitted to the order. Beneficial deeds. Okay? And after he had shown, he had made offerings to the Sangha, then he escorted her with a large gathering of friends and whatnot and took her to the monastery to let her leave home. And she was just happy as could be, the fulfillment of her desire finally come. But, where did she go? To Devadatta's monastery. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so are we going, what's wrong with this picture? Okay, so this is how we're leading up. So, she goes to Devadatta's monastery. And as the time drew near, the other nuns started to notice this change in her person, the swelling of hands and feet, and her increased size. What's this? Yeah, pregnancy is starting to show now. Okay? And they said, you seem to be about to be a mommy. Is that right? And she said, I don't know. I didn't even realize. I know I led a virtuous life, she said, but I didn't know this. And sometimes, you know, to be honest, in some societies, women do grow up not knowing how babies actually come about. I'm not joking with you. There's some people that really don't know the actual facts of how this happens. And so she was very naive and virtuous and had no idea that this activity was actually how obviously the children came about. And she was just saying, I've been virtuous, I've been good, I've been a good wife and everything. But she didn't realize that at that point. So when the other nuns brought her to Devadatta and said, this woman who is about to become a lepton person, with the consent of her husband, has now proved to be pregnant with a child. But we don't know whether this dates before or it happened today. See, they're saying, like, there's a question, and the question, what they're saying is, the question is going to be, if she's admitted and she's pregnant, and the other people find out about this, this might create a little scandal within the Sangha and the community. Okay? What do we do? And then it says, not being a Buddha and not having real kindness and love and sympathy and giving in his heart, Devadatta thought this way: it'll wreck my self-image. It'll be a damaging report that'll get around that one of my nuns is with a child, and that I condone the offense. In other words, within the Sangha, sexual relations are not allowed. So it looks like that. So what is he thinking?
Himself.
Right. So he's thinking immediate self-benefit or self-loss. My course is clear. I have to kick her out. Okay? And without any further inquiry, he just, as he said, it says here, just as he threw a stone in a pile of stones, he said, wait, get the heck out of here, go away. And he kicked her out. And then when they got that answer, they arose and they did their salutation and withdrew. And the girl said to the sisters, and she said, ladies, Devadatta is not the Buddha. Okay? And my vows are not going to be taken under Devadatta, but under the Buddha, because he's the foremost. And she said, you can't rob me of a vacation that I, my vacation that I finally won so with so much difficulty, I finally got here. So take me to the Buddha at the Jetta Grove. So her husband and then took her to the Jetta Grove. So they went out and they journeyed 40 some leagues, it says, and they came to their destination and they bowed before the Buddha and so forth. And so the text goes on, it says, the Buddha had this thought. Probably the child was conceived while she was still a layperson, you know, before she had come forth like this. Yet, it will give the people that are our enemies and critics fuel to criticize the Sangha and to criticize the Buddha's teaching. So he says, to cut short this kind of talk, this case must be presented before the king, so the king knows what's going on. So tomorrow, he sent for the king of Kosala, and also some other people, the disciples, well-known people, basically the people that mattered. And when they were all gathered, male and female, he said, go up and clear this matter out, so the king understands and this young woman can leave home. And the disciples said, it should be done, sir, we're going to do it. And they went forth and they settled the matter with the king. The king understood. But the king said, first there's a way to ascertain, you know, physiologically what happened, when it happened, look at her state. And the women examined her and everything and figured out, yes, this happened a long time ago. It wasn't something at all that impinged and so forth. And once this was reported, then everything was clear and she was able to leave home. And then she went forth really happy, but she was pregnant. And she's in the monastery, and then she gave birth. And when the time came, it says, she bore a son strong in spirit. Now, this could be polite, but he was strong in spirit, or he was just a little hard to handle. When you say someone's strong-spirited, but strong. And for whom she had prayed at the feet of the Buddha ages ago. She had ages ago prayed that if she married, she would have a good, healthy child, and she got that. And one day, when the king was passing by the convent, he heard the cry of the baby, and he asked, what's that sound coming out of the convent? And they, remembering this and everything, they told the king about her. He said, oh, it's her. And then the king said, you know, taking care of children is really a burden for nuns, because they want to cultivate, they want to meditate and whatnot, but they have the kids to take care of. So it really clogs up their religious life. Let us adopt the child and take care of it. Somebody going, ta-da, right? Here's another form of giving, right? And so the infant was gratefully handed over to the king, and the king said he'll be brought up as a prince, okay? And when the day came for him to be named, the king called him Kashyapa, and he was known as Prince Kashyapa because he was brought up like a prince. So I think Kashyapa must be to be brought up as Prince Kashyapa. And at the age of 7, he was admitted as a novice monk under the Buddha. Okay? And when he became 19, he became a full monk. And as time went on, he became famous among the expounders of the Dharma. And so the master gave him precedence, saying, "Brothers, the first in the eloquence among my disciples is Kashyapa." Okay? Later, he became an arhat. And so too his mother, the nun, now grew up to have clear vision, and she became an arhat as well. And Prince Kashyapa, the elder, really reflected well on the Buddha and was really a great disciple. And then it says, let's see, at the close of his daytime address, everybody was getting ready to retire at this time, and someone then spoke as follows and said, so this is now later, the disciples have done what they do during the day, and this is how the tale goes, and they're coming back from having done their alms rounds, and they've seen things happening in the city. And they said, "Hey, Devadatta, because he wasn't a Buddha, and because he didn't have charity and love and giving and beneficence, almost brought the ruin about of this Kashyapa. This kid would have never become an arhat if he had had his way, and his mother would never become an arhat. But the Buddha, being really deeply enlightened and knowing this, and perfect in charity and giving and love and so forth, has proved to save them from this, has rescued them from this fate." And as they were telling this in front of the Buddha, he entered the hall in his graceful, dignified manner and asked them what they were talking about, and they told him. And he said, finally to them, "This is not the first time, brothers, that the Tathagata," meaning himself, "proved to be the salvation and refuge of these two people. He was the same to them in the past also." And then he told this Jataka. But we're out of time. So I guess, anybody know what the Jataka is? What the story is that he told? You want to hear it or you want to? Okay. All right. That's giving of something. The giving of time. Okay. So it says, once when Brahmadatta was reigning in Benares, the Bodhisattva was born as a deer. That's right, he was born as a deer. And he was of golden hue, and his eyes were like round jewels, and the sheen of his horns was like silver, and his mouth was as red as a bunch of scarlet cloth, and his four hoofs were almost as if they were lacquered. And his tail was like the tail of a yak's. And he was as big as a young foal, as a young pony. And he was attended on by 500 other deer, and they dwelt in the forest of the Banyan, the king of the Banyan deer. So they were on a riff, you know, of the kings. And there was another, also another deer with another herd of 500 named Branch Deer. And he was as golden as the Bodhisattva was. And so there was two groups of 500 deer on this estate. And the king at that time really liked to hunt. Okay, Fuel and Stream was his magazine, and he liked to have all these guns. And he had meat with every meal. This guy was quite an American. And every day he mustered all his subjects and town folk and country folk alike, and to the detriment of their business, and said, "Now we're going hunting." He meant for them to chase all the animals so they would come close to him and he could choose to kill. And, you know, they would say, "Well, suppose we were to sow food and supply water for the deer," and then they do that, and then they deliver them over to the king. They said, "How about if we do that? Instead of hunting all the time, we'll just give them food and water, draw near, and then we'll give you some." And so they made this place, they got grass for the deer, and they supplied water and drink, and opened a wide gate. And then called out the townsfolk and set them out in the forest armed with sticks and weapons to find the deer. They surrounded about a league of forest, and they captured the deer in a circle. In doing so, they surrounded all of these deer. And as soon as they perceived the deer, they proceeded to beat the sticks and brushes and drive them out of their enclosement here. And they rattled their swords and spears with such a great noise that they drove the deer right into the king's yard and shut the gate. Then the king, when they went to the king and said, "King, you put a stop to our work by always doing a hunting, so now we've driven deer from the forest here so you can feed on them. We don't have to come every day and do this." And hereupon the king then went to this nice grove, and he saw the herd with the golden deer, and he granted immunity to them, these two special deer. He said, don't kill them, because they're really awesome. And sometimes he'd go up his court and he'd shoot a deer, you know, in the fenced-in area and bring them home. By the way, that's how hunting is done in the United States now. They have these preserves that are fenced in, and you can actually go in and you shoot these animals, big game animals, down in Texas and places like this, and they have no way to escape. They're just in a big fenced-in area, and then you have a picture taken of you standing over what you just shot as if you were a big hero. And sometimes you'd have the cook go and shoot one. And the first sight of the deer, of the bow, the deer would go off trembling for their lives. But after receiving two or three wounds, they grow weary and faint, and then they die. This also reminds me of bullfighting. Sorry. And the herd of the deer told this to the bodhisattva, and he went to the other bodhisattva deer and said, look, our deer are being destroyed in great numbers, and though they cannot escape death, at least they shouldn't be needlessly wounded, because they'd shoot one and they couldn't get it, then they'd shoot another until finally they were out. So he said, let's go take turns, one by one. One day one from my herd goes, next day one from your herd goes, until the lot falls and they just lay down their head and they're executed, rather than, because sometimes they have little deer that would get hurt and so on and so forth. And so they both agreed, and they would do the turns back and back. And the cook was used to this and would carry off the victim every day. So this is what the two, okay, somebody say giving, right? The two are both giving, okay. Now, one day the lot fell on a pregnant doe of the branch herd. And she went to branch and says, oh, master, I'm with a baby. And when I brought forth this little one, there will be two of us to take turn. Let me pass by my turn for now, so I can bring the baby and take care of the baby. And he said, but I can't do that and make your turn another's, because it is your turn. You must bear the consequences of your own fortune. Get out of here. Go to your fate. And finding no favor with him, she went to the other bodhisattva and told her story. And he answered, okay, you go away, give birth here, and I'll see that your turn passes over later time. And then he went back to the place of execution and he laid down his head on the block. He didn't send somebody else. He laid his own head on the block, even though he had been granted immunity. And the cook was saying, what does this mean? And he ran off to tell the king. And the moment the king heard of this, he got on his chariot and arrived with a large following. And he said, my friend, king of the deer, looking at the bodhisattva, he says, did I not promise you your life? How come you're lying here? And he said, sire, there came to me a doe pregnant with a little Bambi and prayed him not to let her turn fall on another so she could give birth and take care of the child and so forth. But I didn't want to ask anybody else to do this, so I'm standing in for her. And he says, great bodhisattva, or great lord, king of the deer, never have I seen, even among people, one so full of love and kindness and charity and giving. I am really pleased with you. Arise, I spare both your life and hers. And he says, though two be spared, what shall the rest do, O king of men? Says the deer. He says, I spared their lives as well. And then he says, sire, only the deer in your area here will thus have gained immunity, but what shall all the rest of the deer do? This is the conversation that's going on. He says, I'll spare their lives too. Sire, the deer will be safe, but what about our friends, the sheep, the cows? He says, all the other four-footed creatures. I'll spare their lives too, he says. Sire, four-footed creatures will be safe, but what about the birds, the two-footed ones? And he said, oh. Now I'm going from beef to chicken.
Oh, okay.
He said, I'll spare them too. Sire, the birds will be safe, but what about the fishes in the water? He said, I will spare them too. And after thus interceding with the king for the life of all the creatures, the great being, the bodhisattva, rose and he established the five precepts. He gave the five precepts to the king. He says, now you can walk righteously, king. walk righteously and have justice and kindness towards parents, children, townsmen, country folk, so that when your earthly body dissolves, you may enter a heaven of bliss. And thus, with the grace and charm that marks the Buddha, did he teach this truth to the king. And the days, no longer did he do any of this, and the herd passed on pleasantly, and the king was happy too. And then the doe was born. There was a fawn, fair as the opening bud of a lotus, it says. It's a wonderful expression. Who used to play about with the branch deer. And seeing this, the mother said to him, "My child, don't go about with him, that deer. Only go about with the banyan deer," meaning the one that saved everybody. And she repeated the standard. She's given this verse. Let me see if I can render it. "Go only with the banyan deer and shun that branch deer's herd. Because more welcome far is death, my child, than the banyan company. Than even the amplest term of life with branch. So therefore, the deer, now with the enjoyment of immunity, used to eat men's crops, and the men, remembering the immunity, did not slay or hit or drive the deer away. And they assembled in the courtyard and made this matter known to the king. And he said, when the banyan deer won my favor, I promised him this. I will forego my kingdom rather than break my promise. Not on a man in my kingdom may harm one of these animals." This is what the king said. When this came to the ears of the banyan deer, he called his herd together, and henceforth he says, "Do not eat the crops then." Because they were saying, "Oh, they're eating, these deer are eating our crops now." But the banyan deer said, "Okay, don't eat their crops. You can only eat what's grown in the woods. Leave them alone. Otherwise, what are they to eat? If you're eating their crops and they're vegetarian, then they don't have any choice. And so, from this day forward, let no farmer fence his field, but near to indicate with leaves tied around up which ones are the plants of his." So they would tie leaves around the corn and so forth, and the deer knew they couldn't. "And so we here begin a plan of tying up leaves to indicate the fields. And never was a deer known to trespass on a field so marked. And for thus they had been instructed by the Bodhisattva. And thus did the Bodhisattva exhort the deer of his herd, and thus did all act this lifelong according to this. And at the close of a long life, he passed away accordingly happy and content. The king too followed the Bodhisattva's teaching, and after a life spent in goodness and giving, he passed away and was then reborn to a happy birth." Okay? So many examples of giving. Now, the end. And at the close of this lesson, the master had repeated that, as now and in bygone days, he had been the refuge of these two. He preached the Four Noble Truths. And he showed the connection, linking the two stories that he had told. And he said, okay, here we go. Who is the branch deer? Devadatta. Devadatta was the branch deer in those days. And his followers today were those followers of the deer then. And the Bhikshuni? Today, she was the doe. Mm-hmm. And Prince Kashyapa? He was the fawn, right? And who was the king? Ananda. Ananda was the king back then. And who was the banyan deer? The Buddha. And that's the end of that Jataka. And the reason my niece really liked this, and her mom, who's not quite a vegetarian, was under some pressure after this. That wasn't my intention, but that's how it worked out. But I tell the story because I thought it really illustrated all the different levels of giving that the text was talking about and the different ways of applying it, and some thoughtfulness to it in terms of even myself reflecting. Sometimes when I think I'm asking of people some things and think it's legitimate to ask them that they owe it or something, I don't always realize that maybe I'm imposing something I need or want, when in fact it would be more beneficial to let them go their own way. So I think there's a lesson here for everybody, parents, children, whatnot, to reflect. Okay, so we went over tonight, but that's okay. It's a wonderful... You knew the story, right? The deer story. Did you know the preface to it, though, before? It's really interesting, isn't it? Yeah, because the story itself is kind of interesting, and it's wonderful. But when you hear the preceding one, that puts you right back into human relations. It's very interesting. It's no longer allegory, but it has a real element to it. So any questions or announcements? Nothing? Tomorrow is nothing. We're not having the sit tomorrow. And we can't have it next weekend because there's board meeting. So it'll be two Sundays, and then we'll start the Sunday sit again. Dharmaster Shri should be back tomorrow or Monday, and so he'll pick up in the text next Saturday or May. That's it. So let's do the transference in English. In the sunbelt.